and welcome back to Let's Jaws for a Minute, the podcast that took a deep dive into Steven Spielberg's 1975 masterpiece and is now setting sail into uncharted waters to discover the world beyond Jaws. I'm your co-host, MJ Smith, and this is the first time I've done this intro for this episode.
And I'm Sarah Buttery, and my laptop just died, so we had to do it again. Fortunately, we'd only got about a minute into it, so yeah. not the end of the world. But yes, we're back. Hopefully. We're talking about An American Werewolf in London this week. So taking quite a big jump from where we've been the previous episodes in this monster movie season. Uh-huh. And it's interesting because I didn't necessarily plan it this way, that it would be like three or four films from the sort of 50s and then three or four films in the 80s. But that's kind of what we've got. And then a little bit of a mixed bag to finish the season with, but there seems to be two very clear and distinct periods in monster movies, and that's the classic 50s Universal monster movies that we've already spoken about, and then this period in the 80s that is interesting still in its own right and very much influenced by some of those older films as well. But the 50s and the 80s sort of seem to be two major touch points, if you will, in monster movies.
Yeah, I mean, well, the other thing is we are very much on accident, I think, doing Universal movies, more or less.
Which is funny because Martin had just assumed that that's what this season was. He was like, oh, you're doing Universal monster movies.
That
and I was
is
like,
what
not exclusively.
Amy thought as well. That's exactly what my partner thought.
Incredible.
Yep.
I haven't run this past you yet, MJ. I think we've got it. I think there's enough monster movies to be able to do monster movie season two. And
yes.
I've enjoyed this one so much
yes.
that I would
yes.
love to.
Yes, yes, yes.
There's definitely some in the classic period that we didn't cover. Yeah. I really want to talk about Dracula, mm-hmm. Wolfman.
So
we'll
good.
Be talking about that maybe in yep. this. But also, like, I mean, some of the 70s ones cross over into a different category or a different season for us,
right.
which is the more obvious Jaws ripoff movies that were spawned by
right.
our beloved Jaws. But
oh, like Piranha 2, The Spawning.
Yeah, literally spawned. There's enough material. I think
yeah.
we could probably do like two or three monster movie yeah. seasons, but I want to avoid the dregs. I know there's some
yeah.
bad ones as well. Like
a lot of bad ones.
Focusing
yeah.
on the yeah, focusing on the better ones of the crop, I think. But
yeah,
yeah, this is 1981's An American Werewolf in London is the film we're talking about today. MJ, where were you able to watch it?
It is streaming on Stars through a subscription, which nobody has. We did a 7-day free trial to
cool.
to get it for free, but you can rent it in all the usual Apple, Amazon, YouTube, any of the rentable places, like $3 or $4. So yeah, it's easy to come by, and it's available on disc pretty easily as well.
Yeah, we're one fancy lads, and also this is one of Martin's favorite films, so we have the Arrow Video Blu-ray, which is a very nice set. He had the 20th anniversary DVD edition of this originally and traded it in for the Arrow Blu-ray copy, so that's where we watched it. He does love this film a lot. I'll probably talk about that as we get into it. It is also streaming on Prime, I think, at the moment.
Mm.
I think just standard Prime, but also some of their channels, MGM Plus and I think Shudder as well, but also can be to rent it on Google Play, YouTube, all the usual places. So pretty easy to find, and get hold of, like some of the other early ones that we've spoken about.
I think that's going to be the case for most of the rest of the season. Is they're going to be easy to come
yeah
by.
Yeah, I think so. I own all of the rest of them on disc, I think, particularly as we spend time in the 80s, we'll realize that a lot of these are my husband's favorite movies, and mine too, so yeah. Definitely readily available in this household, but also everywhere else as well. This film focuses on two American students who are on a walking tour of Britain, where they are attacked by a werewolf that none of the locals will admit exists. And then werewolfy chaos ensues in the titular capital city. It is directed by John Landis, and it stars David Norton, Jenny Agutter, Griffin Dunn, and John Woodvine, amongst others. And MJ, what did you think about An American Werewolf in London?
I mean, great. Great, great movie.
Yeah.
Great. It's I think I'd only seen this once before, and I don't think I had seen it like I'd seen it all at once. I don't think I'd seen it unedited. I think I saw it on TV, like Comedy Central, when it was on, like during Horror Comedy Month on October, when Comedy Central would do that from time to time. So I think this is my first time seeing it in one sitting, and it is so I don't know if you have this with this movie. I can't put into words what works about it necessarily, but it's so like, cause it's pretty slight, like not a lot really happens in the movie, and the characters aren't like that fascinating top to bottom. I think like they're good and all the performances are good. The best character in the movie is Griffin Dunn. But there's something so watchable about it. Like, it's just so easy to watch. And, like, it's not without heft. Like, it's not like there's nothing going on in the movie. Like, there's definitely some... I don't know. I think it's just the tone of it is really nice. It feels like... I think it can be scary. And it's certainly funny. But it's not, like, gut-bustingly hilarious. But the... effects, like technically it's astonishing. I think that goes a long way with it. It's just a really charming movie with like characters who do good at what they're supposed to be doing in the script.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I was so excited to talk about this film, but I was also like, I don't know how easy it's going to be to articulate why exactly I like this film or what it is about it that is so effective. But I'll start by saying it absolutely rips pacing wise. This is only the second time I've seen it, and every single time it has caught me completely off guard by how short it is. And yeah,
97 minutes.
It's so like there's 90 minute or around 90 minute films where it kind of like you feel it, or you're sort of like at a point you're kind of like, all right, this is fine, but let's wrap up kind of thing. And other ones where it just goes by and you know so quickly that it feels like it's about an hour long. This is just perfect, but also there's not, in terms of pacing, but there's not tons of werewolfy stuff until there is, because we
Tons of location change.
The sort of the first half or chunk of the film is spent in what is supposed to be Yorkshire and sort of setting up the two characters, establishing what happens to them. We spend a lot of time with the curious and quirky locals in the pub that they find themselves in. Obviously, the attack happens, and then David, who's the main character, is then recovering. We have a bit of a love story in there as well. We only see him as the werewolf once, and then again at the end.
Twice.
But it's
there's not a ton of
stuff. There's not loads of like big set pieces. There's not like, you know, he turns into a werewolf once and it happens by accident, and then the next time it's like, okay, how can we stop that from happening? Or it's just like, he's just kind of this put upon dude who doesn't want to be a werewolf, obviously. This thing happens to him. He doesn't even acknowledge it's happening to him until it is. And even after that, he doesn't realize what happened. And then it it just kind of ends. Yeah. Like, but it's so great and it's so beloved as well. People freaking love this film.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny too, because like even oh, what's her name? What's
Jenny Agutter is the actress. Alex, the character.
Yeah, Alex. Even Alex tells him, she's like, I'm torn between being really attracted to you and feeling just totally sad for you. Like, he's just like, he's kind of a pathetic dude, but like not by choice necessarily. Like you said, he's put upon, right? Like his circumstances outweigh his ability to deal with them, right? Like, he's not like, because he starts the movie and he's not pathetic. He's just kind of like a guy. He's just a normal, he's just normal men. Just normal
men.
We're just normal men. Just innocent men. And then this happens to him, and like he takes a turn for the pathetic because no one's believing him, but he knows what he's experiencing. And then his dead best friend is coming to talk to him, and everyone thinks he's going insane. So it is like, I don't know if this is intentional, but it is sort of like an allegory for anxiety or panic disorder, where it's like, no, something's wrong with me, believe me. And then people are like, no, nothing's wrong with you. And then like a lot of times with panic disorder, it turns out like, yeah, nothing's actually going on with you. Like, but then it gets you second guessing yourself, where you're like, well, how will I know when this is something that I need to worry about? Right. So I think that's more of a byproduct of the film rather than like an intent behind the script. I think the intent was just to tell a werewolf story. I think the other thing too, is it's just, aside from the effects, which was going to be its own section of this show, because it can't not be, the effects and makeup, but I think it's just really well made. Like the shot composition is really interesting. It's never boring to look at this movie. There's really good camera work in it. There's really good blocking in it. The people who deliver lines deliver them well, which I think is, you know, it sounds stupid to say out loud, but I think is a very difficult thing to do. Like everyone in that bar, particularly because you didn't have a British person writing this, everyone in that bar feels like they're from the north of England, right? Like they don't feel over the top. They feel over the top for a horror in the way that they should for a horror movie, but they don't feel over the top in the way like Dick Van Dyke does in Mary Poppins, right? Like the Britishness of them doesn't feel over the top. The sort of secretiveness of them is what feels over the top, but in the right way for a movie like this. So I think that's the other thing, is despite the circumstances being somewhat supernatural, the film feels very real.
It's for sure like stereotypes, like particularly about like the north of England, where it's just like, I don't know if you've ever seen the comedy series League of Gentlemen, where the shop, like in this isolated location where the two people are just like, this is a local shop for local people, and they hate like any kind of outsiders coming in. So it definitely like plays on that idea of these very like isolated and very insular, particularly rural communities.
Yes.
I have a feeling, I didn't look this up, but that most of the people in that pub are non-actors. I know there is a certain Rick Mayall who is chilling in the pub as chess player number two, I believe. But I think most of those are probably like, this is either the only acting thing they've done, or they were just like people nearby that was like, hey, come and be in this pub scene. So there is a sense of authenticity to it. I think the people who have a lot of lines probably are actors, but the background people are just kind of of there. So it does a great job of setting the scene and instantly feeling creepy but also really funny. And that's what this film nails completely. I mean, you see a lot of films that toe the line or flip between genres. Horror comedies, not an uncommon thing. This isn't the first, certainly isn't the last, but actually it's so difficult to completely nail both of those elements, to be genuinely scary in places with like frightening imagery. The shot of like, it's a dream sequence, but him when he has the kind of like creepy looking face with the big yellow eyes, like creeps me out every single time.
Yeah.
Even the sort of like you see it coming, but the when I can't remember the character Griffin Dunne plays, Jack.
Jack.
Yeah, it's like when he appears like in the mirror, when he, like they do it in Shaun of the Dead as well. It kind of closes the mirror and then like he's suddenly there in the mirror and he jumps. Like it's a good and effective sort of jump scare, but also very funny as well. It's
because Griffin Dunne's shit-eating grin and that scene is so funny.
It's so difficult to nail both of those elements and then both be as effective as each other. Like there's no way you can say in this film the comedy is more effective than the horror or the horror is more effective than the comedy, because they just work so perfectly together. And it's something that we might as well talk about Edgar Wright now, because this is one of his favorite films and I think it's clear to see. You get that in Edgar Wright movies as well. This film in particular, obviously we know he was influenced by Dawn of the Dead and George Romero as well, but like this film in American Werewolf is all over Edgar Wright's films, particularly that like small like British community things, like all the weird people in secret. The pub in Shaun of the Dead, the whole of Hot Fuzz, let's just say. But you can, it's like
the slaughtered lamb being like thematically connected, like the name of the pub being tied in, like in The World's End, like within the first 5 minutes, I was like, okay, well, we have the pub with the thematic name, and then we have like the odd British people, the odd rural British people who are harboring a secret, which is also in World's End as well. And it was just like I immediately texted you as soon as I got to that point, and I was like, is this Edgar Wright's favorite movie? And I found an article where he calls it the movie that changed his life. Like he said that he saw it when he was 14 and he was like, if I can make a movie half as good as this, I will consider myself a success, more or less. And like, you can see that he has stolen so much shit from this movie his entire career. I think this is the well he goes back to the most, and it is obvious. Even the sort of Shaun of the Dead, like two best friends where one of them ends up being a monster sort of thing. Like, it's just all over, especially the Cornetto trilogy. Like those three films feel like him just sort of remixing elements he's loved about An American Werewolf in London.
Yes,
over the
very much so. That dynamic between Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, I think you see in these two characters. And it's, I was saying this to you off mic, it's a shame that I'm always caught off guard by how little of David and Jack we get. Obviously, there's a lot of them in the beginning, but they have such a great dynamic, a great back and forth. There's a lot of improv between them as well that John Landis kept in.
Oh, is there? Okay,
yeah,
that makes
I think
a
there's
ton
a bit, like,
of sense.
It's towards the beginning when they're like, there's other bits as well, but the one that I was reading about is when they like get off the truck at the beginning and like one of them says like goodbye to the sheep. Like one of them,
he says, "I'll miss you." That made me laugh so hard. Griffin Dunn goes, "I'll miss you."
As well. I can't remember what bit it is, but apparently like that one of them said something they weren't supposed to, made the other laugh, and it stayed in because they just liked how that scene looked and they liked how it worked. So they're great.
I bet, you know what? I bet it's the, this is gross, I bet it's the sexual assault joke.
Yeah.
Because Jack laughs at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he says, what they're talking about the girl that he's been pining after, that Griffin Dunne has been pining after. He's like, do you think she'll meet me in Rome? And he says something about, like, what makes you think she's going to lay you or something? And he says she has no choice. And Jack really laughs at that. And I was like, weird. I was like, I mean, 80s. So, you know, I guess we hit that check mark because it's the 80s. But, I think Jack really laughs at that. Or David really laughs at that because he's just, like, completely caught off guard.
Yeah, Griffin Dunne said that moment. It feels, and you see this in Simon Pegg and Nick Frost as well, it's just, like, two people who click just naturally. And it's, like, even while we're trying to, like, do the serious thing and be the actors and do our job and do what we're supposed to, there's just that little bit of underlying, like, I want to make this other person fuck up. because it'll be funny.
Yeah.
And it is.
Even the scene when they're in the pub and Jack is like trying to get David to ask about the pentagram on the wall, and they just keep arguing about who's gonna, like, they're on some Laurel and Hardy shit, like, about which one of them is gonna ask about the pentagram on the wall. And like that bit goes on forever, but in the exact way it goes on forever, in the exact way you would fuck with your friend doing it. Like, it is a perfect distillation of, like, two good friends in a bar not wanting to do something and then just, like, busting each other's balls the entire time over who's gonna ask.
Yeah, that, I love all of this film, but I love the start of that film where it is, like, the two of them and just the rapid fire, like, between them. It just works so well. And I'm always, like, because, like, this is only the second time I've seen it, I'm always like, oh no, like, when Jack dies, forgetting that he does come back in various states of undead throughout the movie, which is very, very funny. So you still get more of them, but they just, there's something about them, just, it just clicks so well between them.
Okay. Yeah, we're circling this. We gotta talk about how fucking good Griffin Dunne is in this good. Movie. He is so good in this movie. He's so good in this movie. He's so good at this. It sucks that it's like this and After Hours are the two biggest things he was known for, because I feel like that dude could have been a mega star, and I don't know why. Like, I don't know if Bill Murray like took his steez or what. Like, I just, he's so quick but dry but compelling to watch. Like, the whole scene when he first shows up to Jack and is, or when he first shows up to David and is just, he's just exposition dumping to him about, like, the mechanics of his lycanthropy. But it's so compelling. Like, the way he delivers it is so watchable. And, like, not just because the makeup effects on him really, really good, particularly in that scene where he's so gross. And apparently they, like, had to cut a scene where he takes a bite out of the toast and it falls out of his throat. And such, I was like, oh, I wish that was in there. Like, it would have been such a good touch. Yeah, that would have been so great. But he looks so gross, but so cool in that scene. And so because he's delivering it with that, like, layer of grossness on him, you're much more compelled by it. And like, the way he delivers it is pretty rapid fire too, so it's not, it doesn't hang up too much, right? Like, it is explicitly an exposition dump, but it just really doesn't feel like it because of how great his makeup is and how good he is as an actor. And we're going to eventually talk about another Griffin Dunne performance on our other podcast, and I can't wait because he is so good in that movie too. Yeah, Griffin Dunne is so, so great in this. And, like, I think it's a perfect use of him in that it is the definition of always leave them wanting more, because I don't know if the movie would have been as good if he was constantly, like, haranguing David about how he has to die. But I want that version of the movie. But because I want that version, that shows that they used him really well in the version we have. Because I want so much more. I'm not tired of it.
I mean, exactly the same. I would have loved more. I'm just thinking about the hilarity of, like, during, like, the sex scene or something. If him just with this, like, shit-eating grin in the background would have been so funny. Yeah. And obviously it's only David that can see him. Just him kind of, like, just in the background of shots, even if he wasn't doing anything, would be incredibly funny to me. But I think...
Okay, I do gotta push back. Is he the only person who can see him? Because they say that, and they imply that in the porno theater towards the end. But when Alex comes out after he's talking to him in the living room, she says, "I heard voices."
I maybe can hear but not see. I don't know. Yeah, I think it's
maybe.
It seems to be that it's only David that can see them, particularly like when there's the whole like crowd of them in the theater at the end. There are other people in this theater as well.
All the other people he's killed are there too. That scene is so funny. That scene where they're just like cheerfully giving him ways to kill himself.
Funny. It's so funny. And it's like
so funny. A gun would be good. That guy and that lady in particular really committed.
I see a lot of like those, that kind of like posh couple in Edgar Wright's films as well. That, like, I can't remember the characters' names. Dylan Moran and Lucy, someone or other, in Shaun of the Dead. That kind of, like, couple dynamic. I see a lot of that, and I'm just like, oh, yeah. But they were, I mean, great. Yeah. I love that scene. And then it's just, there's layers of comedy in that that are so great. It's like, we know that he's potentially about to, like, turn into a werewolf again, so it's just like, oh, what is gonna happen here. There's the things they're saying, which are very, very funny as well, while also being like super dark. And then it's the fact that this
super,
like,
dark
aggressive porn movie is playing in the background.
Dude, oh my god, the porn movie is so funny. With the guy walks in and he's like, I told Jesus to stop doing this. And he's like, are you talking to me or her? And he's like, her. And she's like, I've never seen him before in my life. And he's like, oh, okay. And just leave.
In a non-weird way, I want to see that whole film. It just seems stupid.
Yeah. I want to know how much of that they shot. Like, yeah. I want to know what bits of it ended up in the cutting room
I was reading some stuff about this film today. I believe that was the first thing they shot, which is so... What a way to start the film. The rest of the stuff, like, pretty much they shot entirely in sequence, which is rare, but they kind of wanted this, like, the toll that it was taking on David. And I guess as well, with Griffin Dunne's makeup, like, the decaying over time kind of thing. Obviously you do all that with makeup, but shooting it in sequence, obviously makes that maybe easier to do. But yeah, the shooting the porn movie first is incredible. what a way to kick things off. Like, yeah, let's do this bit first.
I would love to see every joke that they tried to, like, find in that movie, because I think that would be great. But yeah, no, the great point about, like, how dark that scene is, like, with what they're telling him he needs to do, but it threads the needle perfectly of, like, not being offensive somehow, because it could be really fucked up. Like, it could be bad, but it's not. Like, it's just funny in the context of, like, why they're having to compel him to do this. And it just, like, it's the tonal control of the movie is really, really, really great, which is, a credit to the script. And I think we're kind of touching on what makes it work, which is that the first act is all killer, no filler, like, kind of quite literally. The setup to the movie is so efficient and airtight that the rest of the film is able to just balance on that without having to stray.
Yes, very much so. The way that it sets up the premise is so effectively done. It's like, it establishes these two friends, their relationship and their dynamic continues to be important in this and the rest of the film, even though obviously one of them dies. But you have to have that sense of them being these great friends, but also just, like, setting David up as this just, like, sad kind of put upon guy who just, like, he doesn't even want to be in the UK, it feels like, because they're talking about Italy, isn't it? And it's just just like, why are we here? What are we doing? And it's like, he sort of keeps up that attitude for most of the rest of the film. And it's just, but it doesn't suddenly like lose steam then once he gets to London. It just changes slightly. And then obviously it becomes more about, like, is he actually gonna, like, change into a werewolf? You know, the next, like, full moon or whatever is coming, and establishing that relationship, these other characters as well, sort of, that we haven't really spoken about, like the doctors and the what are the two guys who they come in and talk to the doctor.
Oh my god, such a Inspector Villers,
I think that's,
and
them
Mr.
yeah
Collins?
And like one of them, like, he'll talk, and then the other one, the one who's sitting down, like, looks at him and is just like, what are you talking? Like, why are you talking? They have such a great, like, weird dynamic.
Yeah.
It's funny to me without even trying to be.
Well, are you talking about the two guys who visit him in the hospital to, like, you know, one of those guys is Frank
not
Oz?
That guy, but yes, I did know that's Frank Oz.
Oh, okay.
There's one of them, like, knocks over all of, like, the trays in the doctor's office. It's like two guys and one of them is sat and one of them is stood. Yeah. And like the one who is stood is like just absolute chaos in human form, but trying to like establish some authority or like say things, and the other one just looks at him like, no, what are you talking? Like, stop, I'm the one who talks.
Yeah, very Edgar Wright, that dynamic. That, like, I feel like I've seen those characters in Hot Fuzz, you know?
Yes, very much so. But yeah, the Frank Oz is the one who comes, like, into the hospital to see him. Yeah, because I was like,
David.
Yeah. I'm just always distracted by, like, when he's just, like, talking regularly, but it's Kermit.
It was Fozzie. It's Fozzie. Because right? Jim Henson was Kermit.
He sounds like Kermit at weird at points. Maybe I'm thinking of Fozzie.
He's Fozzie, Grover, and Miss Piggy are probably the three. Yeah, but there's one moment where he delivers a line and I'm like, that's fucking Fozzie. Like, that was just Fozzie. What the hell? And it doesn't help that later on in the movie he watches The Muppets. So, like, Miss Piggy's funny. In the movie.
I mean, obviously that was deliberate, but it was a great touch.
Yeah, really good touch. And, like, there's all these weird side characters like that. Like, the detectives. Those two guys just have that one scene with David. Like, they don't come back in the movie. The posh couple is weird. Like, these, like, great side characters, which, once again, an Edgar Wright thing, right? Of, like, you know what? I think I have a sucker for a movie that has really great one-off characters like that. Just show up for a scene or two and are just like, hey, well, I'm here to be weird. Bye.
Basically, all of the people David kills, I mean, well done, David, for choosing, like, hilarious people to kill. But you've got, like, the posh couple, the three homeless guys, the guy in the tube station who has a very, I can't remember what he says, but he's, like, he just makes a really funny remark. It makes Martin laugh when he's just, like, when he hears the strange noise. I can't remember what the quote is, but they show up for like no time at all, say something funny or do something funny, get killed, and then show up again in this like stupid surreal scene in the theater where they're all recently killed telling this other guy to go kill himself. Like, none of that should work on paper, and all of it works because it's so damn funny.
That guy in the tube station is, that scene is so rad. It's so cool. It is some Kubrick shit. Like him chasing, just him down the hallway alone and the cameras following him. I was like, what the hell? I was like, this is some Clockwork Orange shit. Cause he's got like, the hall has like weird proportions because of the curve in it. And then it's the weird tile on the wall with all the movie posters. And he's like full on alone in this, and then he like trips on the escalator, and I was like, he just directed this, like, I was like, oh my god, he directed this like a Kubrick set piece. Like, it feels like a Kubrick set piece to me. And there's like these unsettling 180 degree rule breaks in that, where it's like it's following him, and then we're just in front of him, and you're like, oh my god, like, it's really jarring. And I feel it's like great. That was on purpose. It feels so much like something Kubrick would have done that it feels so purposeful.
Maybe one of my favorite scenes in the whole film, but for several reasons. Like, the way it's so cool.
It's so good.
I almost wish, if I had one tiny criticism about it, I almost wish we didn't see the werewolf, because I love the idea of some of the shots being kind of like POV when he's kind of like, he's fallen on the escalator and then he's like looking down. I would have just had the camera like come towards him and cut. Like, I don't think I needed to see the werewolf in that moment. I could have done without it, but it's so cool. It's so effective, like the lead up to it. And here is Sarah's rubbish claim to fame. That was my tube station where I used to go like every day when I worked in the city. So seeing Tottenham Court Road is always like, it's just really funny to be like, oh, I literally like walked down those corridors like every day for about 18 months. Like, I point it out to Martin every time, even though he remembers. That's funny. Like, I used to walk up those stairs down the end. I used to go up that escalator every day. He's like, yeah, I know.
It that scene's so great. I like that we see the werewolf in that scene because it's not a great look at it still. Like, we don't have a good look at it still, so you're kind of like, whoa, what the fuck? Like, And the cut to the lion is really good.
Maybe my next favorite scene in the film is the, like, waking up naked in the zoo thing. And I was reading about the making of it as well. Like, he did that. He was naked in the wolf cage. Mm-hmm. And the only, like, assurance he had that these wolves weren't going to, like, tear his nuts off was that they had just been fed. And to, like, not make any sudden movements or make too much noise. And I'm like, that's very funny. And that's commitment to the part to be like, yeah, put me naked in this wolf cage. So funny. So funny.
Well, I mean, you know. And then shit like that is how John Landis ends up murdering three people. So.
Yes. To address the proverbial elephant in the room. Unfortunate that is what happened. Yeah, I mean, this could have ended up with him being mauled by wolves as well. Like, great that the actor was willing to do it, but also, you wouldn't have that now, would you? Like, yeah, just put the actor in the wolf cage, it's fine. There's many things about this film where I really appreciate the commitment to going there. I appreciate the commitment to going there with the dark comedy, the gore, certainly. And I think we'll talk about the effects next, because I'm just super buzzing to talk about the effects. But also I always appreciate a film that goes there with, like, full frontal male nudity, because it's rare in films. And it's just like, it's so easy to just, like, show female nudity, and it just feels like that's something there to kind of, I don't know, especially in this context. And I think there was more of it in the original cut as well. And poor Jenny Agutter said something that was quite concerning, which was the day that she was filming the shower scene, there were suddenly, like, more people on set who were very interested in watching that scene being filmed. And I was like, I hope she was okay. But, like,
yeah,
it's not like, oh yeah, they're great, I'm there to see, like, the male nudity. It's not it. I appreciate when they're willing to go there and have it in there, because it makes complete sense. Man has just been a werewolf and woken up, like, naked in a wolf cage. It doesn't linger on the, like, on the moment for too long, but it's just like, there's not many films that actually kind of commit to going there with it.
Well, and it just it just makes perfect sense, right? Like, why would he have clothes on? Right, especially because, well, it's continuity, right? Because we see him rip his clothes off in the transformation scene. Which is one of the coolest things I've ever seen in a movie.
We're now just gonna spend however long just absolutely gushing about the effects in this film, because they are incredible. Rick Baker will use his name, because he deserves to be spoken about forever.
The GOAT.
Won the inaugural Academy Award for Best Makeup. So that was a category that did not exist before, and he won the very first one, and it feels correct because all of the makeup and effects in this are incredible. It's all practical as well, as far as I'm aware. But that transformation, I still don't think I've seen a better werewolf transformation scene. And I've, like, weird that this was the only other thing that popped into my brain, but it was just one that I can, like, remember seeing in the, what is it, the third Harry Potter, Prisoner of Azkaban, when the guy turns into a werewolf, and obviously it's done CGI. It looks crap compared to this, and it doesn't look bad in that. It's fine. But it's like, what this nails so perfectly, and I don't think I've seen bettered, is how fucking painful that must have been. Like, you hear every bone snap, like, you hear and feel the skin stretching. It's gross. It's really gross, and it's incredible that they did this with, like, puppetry. And man, just, it's so cool. Like, the making of this film is fascinating to me. If there are books about the making of this film, like, send them my way. I want to read them. I'm just like, I'm so obsessed with the behind the curtain of this film. I think it's incredible.
I mean, so Rick Baker has a very special place in my heart, in the sense that I think Rick Baker is the first below the line name that I knew, like when I was a child getting into movies. I think he was the first not star that I recognized. Like I saw his work, and it's through, he did the makeup on Men in Black. And I loved that movie as a kid. I think that movie's incredible. And I think the makeup is incredible. Like the makeup on Vincent D'Onofrio in that movie is so great. it's so good. And I remember thinking, like, I thought that was the coolest movie when I was like, the movie came out when I was like 10. And like, I just thought it was so cool. It was like a little scary, but not that scary. And the good guys won. And I just thought it was so fun. And all the makeup was cool. And I remember seeing, I don't know if you guys used to have this where like you would get a free weekend of like HBO or something through your TV provider. They would do that here in the States where it's like this weekend HBO is going to be free for 48 hours or whatever. And like, it was like, it was a sales tactic, but we would always take advantage of it because why wouldn't we? And so, they would do, HBO used to do these like making of documentaries, or essentially like what special features became on DVDs. And so it was like 30 minute making of things for usually like big special effects driven movies. And I think we had a free weekend of HBO and they did Men in Black, as like they showed the making of Men in Black, and they, a lot of it focused on Rick Baker and creature design and all that. And I thought the movie was so great that like, I just was like, Rick Baker, I've got to remember that guy. Cause I like that he's the guy who came up with all this shit. Right. And he's the one who like really made me think about special effects. And I think that's why, because it was such a young age for me, I was introduced to like, there are people behind these things. I think that's why I like a lot of horror movies now. And I have a big time tolerance for a lot of like gore effects, because they're not, because I'm able to separate that they're not real. And so like, when I see a particularly gnarly effect, it doesn't make me squeamish. It makes me go, oh, I bet they had a lot of fun making that. Where, you know, cause even like the super realistic body horror shit that's supposed to get under your skin and like Black Swan, right? Like stuff that really freaks people out, like fingernail stuff. Like, I'm just like, oh, I bet that was really fun to make. Like, and I think it's because I was exposed to Rick Baker's work so young that I just always think about him. So anytime I see Rick Baker and like attached to a thing, I'm always going to be a little bit interested in it. And yeah, I mean, just the goat, I think. Like, take a look at his filmography and it's crazy. He's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 Academy Awards.
The goat. I mean, I'm just scroll.
Yep. Including one for Men in Black.
Down, like, through his credits now, and some of them are films that are like not good, but like, you know that his work in work in those is still great. I don't. Do we have any other films that he was a part of on our list?
I don't think so. I was thinking he might have done The Fly, because that's a Cronenberg movie, and he did Videodrome, but nope. I don't think so.
On like, we're on such a, not just a good run of like 80s like monster films, but like a great run of 80s body horror-y great practical effects run. Like, I have the effects in The Thing. Very good reason why that is one of my favorite films of all time. Incredible. You haven't seen The Fly yet, but you are just gonna love. God, they make like Jeff Goldblum at his most attractive look so hideous, and it's so much fun. It's so fun what they do in that. It that pushes my like body horror gore tolerance like probably to its limits, because it's so, it's so gross. So you are gonna, you are gonna love it. I like the stuff like this. I like the stuff where like the blood is redder than red, and you can see the kind of like syrupy like grossness of it. The Griffin Dunn, where his, when he first appears, and it, I wish they'd kept the so toast cool. thing because it just would have been a great gag. But there's just like a yeah. bit of skin that is just like flapping,
hanging off
on his
like,
face,
cheek.
And it's
yeah,
so gross.
It's so good.
And it's like I couldn't take my eyes off it. I'm not distracted yeah. by the effects yeah. in a bad way, no. but I'm just looking at it like I just want to pause this no. and I just want to look at everything that's going on here to appreciate all of the work mm-hmm. that went into it, because it's not just the animatronics yeah. and the puppetry and the stuff in that incredible transformation scene, it's the stuff with the hair. It's oh god, it's so good. It's so great. The like the limbs extending, and you see that shit in close up as well. There is no hiding yeah. this well, behind like yeah. oh it's happening in the distance yeah. like you see this mm-mm. front and center. But then like the makeup is so mm-hmm. good as well, like the varying states of decay that we see Griffin Dunne's character in. So good.
It's so good. And then he's just like a full-on
amazing.
Skeleton robot
that
by
had
the
to
end
been a,
like
puppet animatronic yeah. by that stage, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's very obviously a puppet,
but it's great.
It's very obviously a puppet, but it's great. It's so good. Like yeah, it's the limb extension is always what gets me. That iconic shot where he like he looks at his hand and it's just elongating, like it's such a cool shot. It's yeah. so fucking rad. And yeah, the hair coming out, and it's full of just this, even you know what yeah. year did this come out? 81. 43 years later, it's just full of like, how the hell, like how did they do that? Yeah. How did like, and it's just, I've always been amazed by that kind of shit, which is, I think is why like in Men in Black, like Vincent D'Onofrio mm-hmm. is so mm-hmm. gross looking in that movie, but like I kind of knew, like I was old enough to and into movies enough to be aware of like, yeah. well, that's not how this guy looks. So how did they do that? Right. Cause even the makeup, the makeup, mm-hmm. the walk around makeup he's in mm-hmm. is like amazing. It's incredible. And to see, like, to be shown, like, this is the person responsible for that thing that you liked. Like, I was just like, oh shit. Okay. Yeah. That's a guy. And I think every sort of cinephile person has their first mm-hmm. below the line person that they really are just like, oh, that's my, okay. Okay. This is another element of this that I didn't know. I think a lot of people came to it through, in our generation, through like the special features yes. on the Lord of the Rings DVDs. I think in a generation previous to us, it was a lot of probably Rick Baker. So Gen X is probably Rick Baker. Before that, like the sort of boomer generation, like the film school brats like Spielberg and Scorsese, yeah. I bet it was Harryhausen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It had to have been, right? And yeah. and King Kong, right? And also special shout out to our boy Rick Baker, who played King Kong in the 1976 version of King Kong.
Did not know that. What a nice little connection.
Yep, he is the actor in the Kong suit in that movie. So that's a connection to an earlier bit of ours. Also, Rick Baker,
mm-hmm.
Sarah, he worked on The Exorcist.
God damn it. Everything is just like steering me towards it, I feel, but it feels yeah. inevitable.
Yeah.
maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Good.
Maybe one day. Weirdly, the most convincing argument you've made so far is Rick Baker being involved.
Not Ellen Burstyn.
The weird religious shit. Not hot, but kind of hot 70s guy. Yeah. I mean, as established, all things that I love.
Yeah.
But there's a special yeah. little place in my heart for really great practical effects. I just, it's why we love Jaws so much, right? Like, I will always, like, yeah. I will, yeah. if I see something has been, like, mostly practical effects or, you know, majority practical effects and maybe, like, a little bit of, like, tuning, it just makes me so happy, like, especially now, because you mm-hmm. just don't see it mm-hmm. as often. And it's something where you can, like, you can see the craft behind it. It's the same reason why I love stop motion animation. It's just, like, someone's hands made this, manipulated it, put this together to make it look as cool as it does. It's just fascinating to me, and it's so fascinating to me because I don't understand it. Yep. Like I don't, I
yeah,
someone
it's magic.
Can sit and explain to me how they did that puppet, the him transforming into the werewolf, and I'll still be like, I don't get it. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't get it, because I just don't understand how someone can pull that off. Not just effectively for 1981, these effects hold up. Like, they still look great. And if it, like I've said this before, and I'll continue to say it, like, nothing dates a film more than, like, of the time special effects. And particularly
Labyrinth.
Particularly
the owl
in
Labyrinth.
We might have
Woof.
This when we get to The Mummy as well. I love that film dearly, but I think there's probably things in it that look very 90s, and that's okay. But
I'm very interested to see. Yeah, I picked up the 4K of that movie, and I'm very interested to see what those effect shots look like in 4K. Because even, I'll say it, I haven't seen the 4K. I've heard that it's supposed to have improved this. The Blu-rays of Lord of the Rings, they're a little dicey these days. Like, particularly in Fellowship, when Gandalf rides away on the eagle from Saruman's spot. Like, it didn't look great. Like, and I remember being like, ooh, this isn't as mind-boggling as I remember it being. Like, you can see the seams on this a little bit more than I remember. Hey, but on the other side of that, there's really great practical effects in it. And I think, by and large, Gollum still does hold up as a CG creation. But it's just like, it's like the sort of incidental CGI in those movies really make it, like, whereas, like, and same with Labyrinth, where 90% of that movie is puppets and it looks amazing, but there's the CGI owl, and that thing is brutal. Like, it's rough. Even with this, like, when they show the close-ups of the skin with the hair pushing through, I know exactly how they did it. It doesn't make it look any less cool. Like, I know exactly the process they did. They just made a little patch of skin and just did a close-up on it, and then, like, pushed threads that look like hair through the back. They just have an apparatus that it's pretty easy as far as, like, an effect goes. It's not, like, it's not that mind-blowing of a mechanism, but it just, in the way it's cut into the film, looks incredible. It looks astonishing. Like, it's so cool. And this is, like, my big, besides the fact that John Landis is a fucking murderer, this is a weird hang-up I have, like, where it's just, like, you know, he did kill people, but he has also made some good movies. Like, I know people love Blues Brothers, which I haven't seen, but, you know, the there's a lot of technical merit in this movie. There's a lot of technical merit in that with the car chase. I think there is also some troubling warning signs about how we got to Twilight Zone with the way he handled the car pileup in Blues Brothers, as well as putting David Naughton in the wolf cage, and my guess would be the massive car pileup in this, which is really cool, but it's also like, all right, man, like, knowing what happens 2 years later, how are you protecting the people on your set? Because I feel like you fucking weren't. All that to say, like, it's very strange to me that he directed Three Amigos. I love that movie. It's very strange to me that he thinks that the transformation scene is too long.
Yeah, I was reading that as well. I would have watched it in more detail and longer and in slow motion. That is like this. That is the set piece, the center. Like, that's what we're here for. We want to see this American in London turn into a freaking werewolf. So show us all of it. I don't think, unless that scene was like 30 minutes or something insane, I don't think that scene could be too long. And also, you have the goat doing the effects. Like, show them off even more, so even more than it already does. But it's so rare to spend that much time, like, on the transformation and see, like, every aspect of it, because every other time you see it in a film, it's kind of like done in a few seconds. 10, 20 seconds maybe at most. This is, mm-hmm. even in the form that it is minutes. And like we feel it. It feels painful, gross, really cool as well. Like really cool to look at. So I don't know why you would want to cut that down. And this isn't a film that sort of like ever feels like it outstays its welcome. Like quite the opposite. It feels like you could probably add like maybe 5 to 10 minutes into this film and it still be great. I mean, I'm glad that it is as short and pacey as it is, because it rips from start to finish. But yeah, I would love to see the sort of extended version of that sequence. I think this is a film that deserves it. Like, there's not tons of werewolf stuff when you look at the film as a whole. And it's not like, boo, give us more werewolf, because all the rest of the stuff is still great. But I don't know, I happily would have watched more of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's so cool, man. Like, it's so rad to watch. And David Naughton is amazing in that scene. I think, like, just the desperation and, like, the way you can feel him pushing against this transformation is so good. And I think that's another thing that the movie handles really well, is the tragic nature of the character, where like the outcome is for him to die. That's the only thing that can happen in this movie. And, you know, he didn't ask for this shit. He didn't sign up for this. He doesn't want to die. He's like, you know, his logic behind staying alive makes sense, which is, I didn't fucking sign up for this. Like, why do I gotta die? But then he has to confront like the unintended consequences of that, and then it like kind of fucks him up, and then he gets killed anyway as the wolf, which he still doesn't have a say in. And it makes it sad. Once again, it's another bump. It has the same ending as King Kong. It has the exact same ending as King Kong. Like, full on. It exactly the same thing. And beat for beat, the end of King Kong
it's great. It's a really bold ending as well, because for a couple of reasons, I think it's rare to see a teen-focused or teen-targeted film end with both of the main dudes not being alive at the end of it. The evil is defeated, but he is the evil, and it isn't like, you know, some movies kind of like get around this by being like, oh, they killed the evil part of him and then he gets to stand up at the end and he's back. Like, they killed the wolf part of him, now he gets to go back to being, it's like, no, he was the evil. And like, yes, it's funny, but all these characters spent like the bulk of this movie being like, kill yourself, bro. Like, because we're now doomed or cursed to sort of walk this earth as the undead, and we want this to be over with as well. But the end of this film is great, because it echoes all of those, the things that we've been talking about the last few weeks, the just bummer endings of these monster movies. That thing that we like about the classic monster movies as well is that we feel sorry for the monster. The monster isn't really the monster, and it's the same in this. He's just a guy, and this bad thing happens to him. Yeah. He didn't ask for any of this. So it's just an innocent man. And like, it ends with him dying, and it's a super bummer. But then also it ends on like the doo-wop version of Blue Moon, which is fucking hilarious.
Let's talk about the soundtrack.
I would hate a film that had a soundtrack that was this on the nose. I'd be like, oh, it's like the Cruella, you know, finishing on Dog Days, or no, it doesn't finish, it finishes with the lady who sings Dog Days Are Over, but it has I Want to Be Your Dog in it, because it's about a dog.
By the Stooges?
And like,
I didn't know that. That's so stupid. That sucks.
It probably finishes on Sympathy for the Devil, doesn't it? Because what film doesn't?
I'm sure it does.
Hey, gross. And if you if this film sucked and you're like, yeah, every single song in this is like moon themed or wolf themed, I'd be like, don't like that. But it, why does it work so well in this? There's three freaking versions of Blue Moon. It uses every version of that song that exists.
There's
One of the best uses of Bad Moon Rising in a film, and that song is used a lot in films.
I hate it. I don't like that. I don't
really,
like that.
Really, I think it's great. It works.
Yeah.
It works for me.
I think it's annoying. I think it's so stupid. Surprise. It's so strange. The strange thing about the soundtrack to me, one, Moondance is in it, which I do like the use of Moondance. Blue Moon is in it a bunch. Really, 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 really surprising move to not do Werewolves of London in this movie.
Yeah, it was one of those things, I was reading about it, where it's just like, people even now, as you are like, why didn't they use that song? And John Landis is like, yeah, I don't know why we didn't, that was stupid. So it wasn't even like, we couldn't get the rights, or there was a reason, it was just like, we should have done that, I don't know why we didn't, we're dumbasses. Which is funny.
Oh, okay. Because, so here's the thing. I not only love, like, Werewolves of London is one of my all-time favorite songs. I fucking love that song so much. But more importantly, a Desert Island album for me, like, the arguably the album I throw on the most when I don't know what to listen to is Excitable Boy by Warren Zevon. I don't know how familiar you are with that record, but the title song, Excitable Boy, is also very darkly funny. I will not read all the lyrics here because the titular Excitable Boy does some heinous acts in this. But there's a part where he says, so the plot of the song is about this psychopath kid that everyone is just like, he's just an excitable boy. And then he ends up doing a murder, and other things. the second verse says he took in the 4 a.m. show at the Clark and bit the usherette's leg in the dark. Excitable boy, they all said, is the how that ends. But like, the climax of the movie takes place at a late night showing of the porno movie, and he attacks the usher. And I was like, he's the excitable boy. I was like, how do you have your whole movie be a Warren Zevon reference? And then you do the scene, you do the second verse of Excitable Boy, and you don't use Werewolves of London. Like, stupid. What the hell?
It probably doesn't make any sense. As much as I love the hilarity of ending on that particular version of Blue Moon that this film does, that would have been a like closing credits song. Like, it's like the great song that they use in Crawl at the end credits, which is never not funny. This is an Edgar Wright thing because he knows his music very well, but like, I think the soundtrack for particularly for sure Shaun of the Dead is great. Like, I think the first song is Ghost Town. The special is Ghost Town. Great. Like, every song choice in that film is perfect. In fact, it Hot Fuzz, it continues into all of Edgar Wright's movies. But
to the point where he just built an entire movie that, right? Like, he was just like, hey, I'm pretty good at soundtracks, time to make Baby Driver. Like, movie's just a music video.
Let me put them into one film.
Maybe make music videos for all my favorite songs.
Well, speaking of music videos, probably a very well-known fact is that it was this film that inspired a certain Michael Jackson to make probably the most well-known music video of all time. So he hired John Landis to direct it and Rick Baker to do the effects in that, based off of this film. So if you were intrigued about the legacy of an American werewolf in London, it's that because of this film we got the video to Thriller, which is one of the greatest music videos of all time. And also, side note, Michael Jackson picked a good director for his films. I mean, like, Scorsese does bad, so, you know.
Yeah, Scorsese does bad. Well, because he worked with every film school Brad except for fucking Spielberg, because Captain EO was directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
I miss when, like, music videos were, like, an event. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was a whole thing. There's not many now where there's some, like, good music videos where you're like, that's cool. But it seems to be just because of how disposable stuff is. It's like it's the TikTok clip rather than, like, the music video or whatever, isn't it? But
yeah. Yeah. I love a music video. Love a music video. Sometimes me and my roommate will stay up most of the night sharing music videos with each other.
I mean,
we'll be up till 3 or 4 in the morning just hyper focused on music. Like, it just fucking rabbit hole.
I mean, I was born in 91, so I had like just enough MTV playing music and music videos for it to have had like an impact on me. I love Blink-182, but like there's some of their music videos where I'm like, those have stuck in my brain because they were normally like really funny and really stupid.
They had great
videos.
I remember
the Green Day basket case video really well. Like, me and my brother would just like scroll through the music video channels, because there used to be a whole bunch of them, just finding the cool ones to watch. I'm sad that like people don't get to. I mean, you still get to have it through going down the YouTube rabbit hole, but it was fun having like whole TV channels that would just show music and more importantly music videos. Because, I mean, one of my favorite music videos of all time is it Weapon of Choice, the Christopher Walken.
Oh, it's so good, so good.
It's great.
So
it's
good.
Just Christopher Walken dancing. Like, what? There's nothing more. That's it. Like, no notes. Yeah. It's great. It's incredible. But like that.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything now where I'm like, I can think of a song that I really like, and I can think of the music video that goes along with it, and I associate those two things. It just the same effort just doesn't seem to be put in anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't want to tar everyone with the same brush, because I'm sure there are artists who put a lot of thought and effort into their videos, but. There was a golden age for it, and that was a long time ago.
Yes. There is, I mean, there's a full, you know, shut the fuck up, Sarah. I know I'm telling you to shut the fuck up, but this is my idea. Do you know if there's a music video podcast out there? Because I feel like that's a whole idea unto itself.
Right now. You take that idea and you put it in the drawer of things that maybe we'll do at some point in the future, but not now, because I love that idea.
That's such a great idea. I don't know how.
There's
I'm sure there's a music video podcast. There's gotta be. But so before we started Party with Marty, I went and watched the Bad video. Have you watched the Bad video?
Oh, I sure have.
Recently? Zooey Mama.
Directs the
it is
shit
so good.
Out of that video.
It's so good. It's so good.
I needed to go that hard on a music video, but it's great.
No. That music video is like, it's astounding. It is crazy how good that music video is. Well, and then what's funny is like, have you seen the music video for Fat by Weird Al? Because they do an incredible job
a long time ago
of recreating it. Well, so the story behind it is that, you know, Michael Jackson loved the Weird Al parodies. Like, he was in full support of them. And so Eat It was a huge hit. And then he was like, Michael, I'm going to do Fat instead of Bad. And Michael Jackson was like, oh, let me give you the address of the parking structure where we filmed it. So, like, it's the actual same set as Bad.
Great. And there's, like, a long version of Bad as well, isn't there? There's, like, an 18-minute version, and then there's, like, the cut version that they would actually, like, show on MTV. But it's just, like, what business did they have going, like, that hard on a music video?
I gotta, like, okay, we gotta pull ourselves out of this rabbit hole, but, I gotta send you the music video for Josh Ritter, Evil Eye, because it is set up like an Argento movie. It's set up like a trailer for an Argento movie. To the point where they released a fake poster for the fake movie, Evil Eye. I have the poster in my kitchen right now. I have a poster for a fucking music video. And it's amazing. It's so good. I'll send it to you once we get offline. But yeah, I love a music video. And so the fact that we got this based on American Werewolf in London, or the fact that we got Thriller based on American Werewolf in London, is like S tier to me, because that is really one of the greatest music videos of all time. Last thing about Thriller, there is a 4K restoration of it on YouTube that you can watch, and it is
Guess what I'm gonna queue up to watch once we finish recording.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so gonna go down this music video rabbit hole, because thing is, once you start watching one, YouTube's then like, oh hey, do you want to watch this other one? Or there's just like a playlist of probably a video playlist of I probably want to go into like 90s, maybe early noughties kind of stuff, because that was when I was scrolling endlessly through the music video channels. But
there's still good ones coming out today. The hip-hop artist Prof has a lot of really great ones. Run the Jewels has some really good ones.
I was gonna say is that like I can't think off the top of my head the last like great music video I saw that was, I guess, like in the last like 5 years or so.
Prof has one that's it's a Mr. Rogers parody. And it's really good. Yeah, it's Squad Goals is the name of the music video. Okay. 3 years ago is when it came out. It's super dope. It's really good.
It's very good to know that there are still artists that like put that effort in. I think because obviously, like, I mean, YouTube hasn't gone away, and for a lot of people, that's actually like how they stream their music because it's free. So, you know, yes, most of the time it's people are kind of listening to it in the background, but like actually having something that is there and accompanies the music but is also like iconic, like in its own right, I think is rarer now than it used to be. But
certainly but there are still people keeping the art of the music video alive that are just like, that's what we do. Like, there's a lot of really good Prof music videos, and I'm so on his music. Like, I don't think I would throw his music on Spotify, but he marries his songs so well to his music videos that it's hard to deny.
Yeah. Oh, man, I gotta stop thinking about this podcast now, because why is every idea we have great?
Yeah. Burdened with glorious purpose.
Sometimes you're just really good at what you do. And
sometimes you're just really good.
I mean, I didn't just WhatsApp you a potential title for it. That wouldn't be something that I would.
Oh no! God damn it, Sarah!
That I would have done.
Video killed the internet radio star.
Thing is, like, obviously we occasionally on podcast talk about other great podcast ideas that we have, but our off mic conversations, 70% here's a great idea I've had, no we don't have time, is we would, if we followed through on all of the podcast ideas we had, we would have about 10 podcasts now. Well, look, stay tuned. Sure. Maybe at some point.
Join the Patreon.
Please, Lord, we need a lot more money before we start another podcast. I'm not sure if I have anything else to say about this film. I'm now just very distracted.
No, it's great. It's just so unique. Like, there's not anything quite like it, really. Like, it's just so offbeat in the best possible way. Like, I can't believe it's a fucking Universal movie. Like, this is a major studio motion picture. That's insane to me these days. Like, this is something, if this came out now, as is now, this would be one of the, like, unsung gems on, like, buried on some obscure streaming service. Like, that just some random group of people in an indie studio threw together and like tossed on Shudder or some shit. Like, there is no way a movie like this would be financed by like Universal Studios these days.
Yeah, and it's so, I think this is one of the things that Edgar Wright tapped into, and I read that article that you sent me where, I mean, it's really short, but it's just him talking about how much he loves this film. Mm-hmm. But I think in that article he said about one of the things that really appealed to him about An American Werewolf in London and has clearly transferred over into the movies he makes is this idea of a film being like ingrained in popular culture. It's just like this feels so of its time, but yet still there are elements of it that are relevant to today. It's also it doesn't just reference the Wolfman. It references in itself that there is referencing the Wolfman, if that makes sense. Like, he has a whole bit, David, talking about the Wolfman and how what is happening to him is like that film. You would see that shit in an Edgar Wright film. Like, you would, I love that ton-in-cheekness of it, where it's just like, yeah, we know the past of monster movies. We know that this is like another werewolf film, and there is the Wolfman, and there is, you know, other werewolf movies as well. Excuse me, but it's, yeah, like, we're not just gonna like reference it in subtle ways. We're gonna reference it by out loud saying the name of this film multiple times throughout the film, which is great.
Yeah, the last thing I will say about it, and then you guys had some thoughts this one, is, I guess it's not technically about this, it's more about the Werewolves of London thing. I do think it's funny that, like, the iconic use of Werewolves of London in film comes in The Color of Money and has basically nothing to do with the scene. It's just rad.
Great.
Just super cool. And it's awesome. That sequence is amazing, but... It's just such a missed opportunity off that soundtrack. Like, it's so strange that is not in it. That it didn't even occur to them is insane.
I think it's so funny that they had, like, it's so, you're in a film that is full of very obvious music choices, yet you missed like the most obvious one. That they just had to like hold their hands up and go, yeah, you know what, we're stupid. We should have done that. And we've got no explanation for you. Sorry.
I just like, I feel like they were like, here's our movie. And then someone was like, how the hell is Werewolves of London not in this movie? And they were just like, oh, yeah.
Whoops.
Huh. Yeah.
What a couple of silly, silly gooses.
Yeah. Man. All right. We tweeted about your thoughts, to ask for your thoughts. And we got ahead of it. Finally. we have a lot. Did we get any more?
While you're reading, I will double check just to make sure, because but we got quite a few.
Yep. At Gemma Rogers 79 said, best use of animatronics ever. Still holds its own after all these years. Absolute breathtaking makeup and special effects. Hard agree. I mean, one of the best ever. At Adam P. Dallas says, best werewolf film ever made. One of my all-time faves. Wolf emoji. Tragic, scary, and funny with groundbreaking effects. At Foxy Snob, what can I say? The soundtrack, the practical effects, love it. Beware the moon, lads.
Stay off the moors.
yeah, stay off the moors. Wrath of Khan says, stay on the path. Yeah, that'll keep you safe when there's a hungry werewolf running about the place. at Johnny Fourboats himself, M_Nick89. Of Nickflix says, small thing, but I love the Blue Moon song playing at the end. I mean, the thing is, they did the best version of Blue Moon for the end, just because I fucking love Sam Cooke.
It's the funniest the first version of Blue Moon you hear in the film is kind of like the I guess the most classic one. That's the sort of like the croonier sounding one, but like ending it on the upbeat like doo-wop version in the end credits is such yeah. a great touch, because of all the versions, that's the one you end it on after this like bummer of an ending, really sad, tragic mm-hmm. ending, and then you're like ending it on yeah. a gag, have a well, fun song, bye.
Yep. Well, we're good. We're about to talk about a movie that does that, and yeah. on our Patreon.
Can't wait.
Next month. Yeah. Oh, patron shout out. Right. Forgot about that. Yeah. Speaking of our patron episodes, you guys got our episode on Colossal recently, which is yep. a really good movie.
Episode as well.
yeah. Yeah. my girlfriend has a Ted Lasso like poster on her wall in her home office. And she texted me and was like, I don't know how I feel about having Jason Sudeikis on my wall after like, that movie.
You were so mean. You were so mean to Anne Hathaway. Yeah. Why did you do that?
Yeah. Yeah. But if you'd like to hear that along with 14 other bonus episodes, covering the gamut from Megalodon science through terrible shark movies and beyond, you can find our Patreon at patreon.com/jaws4aminute. Shout out to our patrons: Tim, Eric, Blake, Andrew, Rachel, Katie, Mike, Callum, Cameron, Jack, Chris, and the Uncut Gems podcast. We appreciate it so much. That is the reason why we're able to do our other podcasts. It is new mic month Woo! For MJ. and that is exclusively because of you guys and the help you've thrown our way with your donations every month, and we couldn't do it without you. Also, dead serious, like, the more people join, the more time we'll have to do podcasts. If you want to hear us do some of these other ideas, like, that's the only way we're gonna get to do them, and we really want to do some of them, so tell your friends. But it does mean a lot that even any of you are willing to part with your money each month to help support do whatever this is, the pure chaos that this show can become, as well as, like, I would say pretty good film analysis, but also
yeah.
a lot of silliness.
Yeah, mostly well. Two silly little guys who occasionally say intelligent things. We...
Yeah. That should be the name of yeah. all of our podcasts.
Yes. That is, I feel like, the description of us as podcast hosts. The summary. Mm-hmm. We sometimes say slightly more intelligent things on our other podcast, but, you know, mileage may vary, which is Let's Party with Marty. And speaking of the patron, we've sort of kind of been floating around potential ideas for patron spin-off of that podcast as well. So if that is something that maybe you would like to hear, then mm-hmm. let us know. And also, the more patrons we get, the more time we have to do all these things, as MJ said.
Yep. And then we can use that as a backdoor pilot for our music video podcast, because you'll get a patron episode right? about Bad.
And also, Sad Dads and Mad Lads is still one of the best ideas we've had. We don't know what yep. it'll look like, but we love the names.
Yeah. I mean, first episode, The Exorcist. Let's go.
That will be what gets me to watch it. If we suddenly get like an influx of patrons, that means we can start a third podcast, then fuck it. Let's do it. So wherever you found Let's Jaws for a Minute, you can also find Let's Party with Marty. I think our next episode on that, I don't know about the recording schedule, but the next one we're recording anyway is Taxi Driver. So we're getting into some,
Woo.
Yes, meaty Martin Scorsese films to talk about.
I'm so excited.
Very, very excited. We've got Jakob coming on to talk about that from the Uncut Gems podcast, so be prepared for that episode to maybe be 3 hours long. I've cleared my schedule.
12-hour podcast.
Go. Yeah, I cleared my whole day for that podcast, because I've been there before with Uncut Gems. I know how it usually goes down. That will be the next one that we record, but we've double digits episodes into that podcast now. I can't remember exactly how many. So if mm-hmm. you like what we do here, then hopefully you'll like that also. And go and give that a listen. If you want to follow us, the podcast that is, on social media, we are on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Jaws for a Minute. There you will find our link tree, which has got a link to our Patreon page where you can buy merch, I believe links to listen to Let's Party with Marty as well, and various other bits. You can also find us individually on Twitter. I am at Sarah Buttery and MJ is at MJSmith891. If you are not on social media, good for you. that sounded more sarcastic than I intended. Well done. Pleased for you.
Oh, good for you. You did the Christian Bale in
Look,
Terminator,
I'm British. There's no way to make something congratulatory sound not sarcastic, but well done. you can on social media, you can contact us by email, jawsforaminute@gmail.com. If you have any longer thoughts, correspondence that you want to send us, we always enjoy reading those, so you can send us whatever you want. Thoughts on this film, thoughts on other films, thoughts on all of our thousand of other podcast ideas we've had, you can send those all to us. What is our next, is our next episode The Thing? Oh, I'm so excited. Yep. Not to just give anything away too much, but that is in my top five films of all time, so to say I'm excited is an understatement. We also have Andy Godian from Ramblin' Amblin' joining us for that, hopefully, which should be great. Always great to chat to Andy. Go, and if you have, for whatever reason, if you haven't seen The Thing, go and watch it. It's real good. Real good. Yeah. I've seen that film, so I could record a podcast right now talking about The Thing without watching it, but I'm still gonna watch it.
I mean, yeah, the last time I watched it was last October, and like I watch it probably once a year.
I think I watched it
it's not
been that long.
but I got the 4K locked and loaded, so
beautiful. Oh,
not gonna not watch that shit.
I'm excited for you. Just that's gonna look. It's gonna look so excited. Oh, anyway. That's next time. So until then, it's Jaws O'Clock Somewhere.